This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about a recent victory in the case of so-called enemy combatant Ali al-Mahri.
This crucial and important decision may cut the heart out of Bush's claim that he can arrest, kidnap, capture, and detain anyone, anywhere in the world, and hold them forever as so-called enemy combatants. It's a big victory, but will it hold?
And speaking of holding people, we'll talk about a recently issued report entitled Off the Record, U.S. Responsibility for Enforced Disappearances in the War on Terror.
The real question is, where is the outrage? 39 people, missing, possibly gone forever, kidnapped, captured, possibly murdered by the United States.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
These are few and far between, but today we're really excited to bring to you a victory in one of the so-called enemy combatant cases in a U.S. court. The man we're concerned by is named Ali al-Mahri, and he was a legal resident or legally in the United States for work study when he was picked up and detained by the Bush administration as a so-called enemy combatant. They kept him incommunicado for a number of years. Finally, he got a lawyer and went to court, argued that it was unlawful to hold him as an enemy combatant without giving him a right to challenge his detention, and that the military had no right to actually hold him as an enemy combatant, but they had to be charged with a crime. The lawyer for al-Mahri at the Brennan Center in New York is Jonathan Heifetz, who's a lawyer we at the Center for Constitutional Rights have worked with over a long period of time, a wonderful lawyer, and took his case to a very conservative circuit court, the Fourth Circuit, not because he wanted to go there, but they actually had imprisoned al-Mahri in South Carolina so that al-Mahri's case would go to a conservative court. Surprisingly, and happily, at least for now, the Fourth Circuit said the president cannot hold lawful people in the United States as so-called enemy combatants, and that they have a right to challenge their detention, and that they have to either be charged with the crime or released or held in some other legal fashion, such as a material witness. But they cannot be held as enemy combatants. It was a 2-1 decision. The government has already said they're going to appeal to the full circuit court, but it is a major, major decision because underlying it, apart from the U.S. link to it, underlying it, it undercuts the president's entire concept that somehow he can charge people who are alleged terrorists as enemy combatants and hold them forever under the so-called laws of war. So it could even have a wide effect on Guantanamo detainees and other people picked up in the so-called war on terror. We're especially pleased to have with us Jonathan Heifetz, who is the litigation director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Project and the lead counsel for Ali al-Mahri. Welcome, Jonathan, to Law and Disorder. So, Jonathan, really our first question to you is, what is this case? Who is al-Mahri? Where was he in prison? What's the significance?
Well, Michael, this is a very significant case. This is an individual, a civilian, who was arrested in the United States by the FBI. He had come here legally with his wife and five children to obtain a master's degree at Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois. He was arrested and charged charged with credit card fraud and making false statements to the FBI. And he was detained and awaiting trial. He was handled in the criminal justice system through the ordinary course, and he asserted his innocence. But before his trial could commence, the prosecutor showed up in court one day with an order from the president declaring him an enemy combatant, and it suddenly transforming him into a person protected by our Constitution, protected by our Bill of Rights, into someone without any rights at all. They took him to a military brig. They held him incommunicado, solitary confinement, and subjected him to a range of torture and other abuse while he was there.
Jonathan, what was he charged with?
Well, he was charged in the criminal case with as a credit card fraud and making false statements to the FBI.
But then after they got rid of that case, what did they charge him with as an enemy combatant? Did they charge him? What did they say?
Well, they didn't bring any charges against him. What they alleged was that the enemy combatant designation was originally based on a one-page redacted order issued by the press, signed by the president, saying that he presented a danger to the United States and had come to the United States to commit hostile and warlike acts. Subsequently, after we sued the government in a habeas corpus petition on his behalf, all the government produced in response was not charges, but a triple hearsay declaration of a faceless government bureaucrat, which alleged that Mr. Almari was a Al-Qaeda sleeper agent and made a whole number of allegations about contacts with Al-Qaeda officials, you know, incriminating matters on a computer and a whole bunch of different things. But they never presented any evidence, no witnesses, no hearing, just rested their whole case upon this, basically this statement from someone that someone made up sitting at their desk in Washington.
So let's just say what they were saying the president could do is simply take someone who came into this country legally to study, as I recall, at Bradley University, study there. He could get picked up by the president, designated as enemy combatant, tossed into a prison, and not be seen or heard from again, and kept basically forever. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And Michael, it's not only foreign nationals. They assert the same power to disappear people as enemy combatants if they're citizens. And that's what they did in the Jose Padilla case.
Now, when you went first to the district court and you lost, as I recall, right?
That's correct.
And then you went up to the Court of Appeals in the Fourth Circuit, and you can talk a little bit about what the Fourth Circuit's like. There were two issues. There was a sort of newish issue because of the habeas issue in the Military Commission Act, and then there was the underlying issue of can you simply pick up people, not charge them with the crime in the United States and hold them forever. So why don't you go through what your thinking is and what the victory was about?
Yeah, I mean, there were two issues. The first issue was the issue of whether he could be held as an enemy combatant, or instead had to be charged and tried in the civilian system as the Bill of Rights require. While we lost in the district court said the president had the power to hold him as an enemy combatant. While the case was on appeal in the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit in October, Congress passed the Military Commissions Act of 2006, which had a number of different features. And the one that was relevant to this case was to eliminate habeas corpus for certain aliens detained as so-called enemy combatants. When that act was passed, the government then moved to dismiss the entire appeal, saying that the court had no power over his habeas case. There was no habeas corpus review of his detention, and sought to dismiss his case, have his entire case thrown out of court, and to prevent the Court of Appeals from even hearing Mr. Almari's appeal. So that was the issue that went to the Fourth Circuit. Now, the ruling, all three of the judges on the panel rejected the government's first argument, that is that the act stripped Mr. Almari, a lawful resident alien, of his right to seek habeas corpus review. It affirmed that the court retained habeas jurisdiction over a legal resident in the United States. Turning to the larger question about whether he could be detained as an enemy combatant, the panel ruled in a 2-1 decision that the president did not have the authority to hold him as an enemy combatant, that this type of detention that is calling, snatching someone off the street or from their home and jailing them in a military prison without charge would have disastrous consequences for the Constitution and the rule of law in the United States, and it rejected this measure, which has really been kind of a centerpiece of the administration's counterterrorism policy.
Now, Jonathan, there's two other aspects I want to ask you about. One is, of course, there were two other so-called enemy combatants who were either citizens, both of them were citizens, I think, Hamdi and one is Padilla, who were held in the United States as enemy combatants, at least for various periods of time. And were those two cases, according to the court, similar to this case? Does that have implications for those? Or was it this case in somehow way different in terms of the court's thinking?
Well, similar and different. It was really different from the Hamdi case. You know, so I'll talk about that first. Hamdi was a citizen, and he was detained eventually at the same place as Ali Al-Mari and Jose Padilla. But it's a very different case. He was picked up or seized in Afghanistan in a war zone carrying a rifle. He, you know, appeared like a combatant, what we understand to be a combatant, someone who's traditionally been subject to military detention. He was taken to Guantanamo and held there, but after in 2002. But a few months later, the government realized that he wasn't actually a foreign national. He was a U.S. citizen. So they took him from Guantanamo and put him in military brig in the United States, first in Virginia and then in South Carolina. So the issue in his case was that what the court ruled was that the president could hold someone like him as an enemy combatant, someone picked up in Afghanistan on a battlefield, as long as they gave him the opportunity to prove that he wasn't who the government says, that he was an innocent civilian or someone else mistakenly swept up in the chaos of wartime.
They, meaning, again, the Fourth Circuit.
Sorry, the Supreme Court.
Oh, was the Supreme Court said that?
Supreme Court. Yeah, Supreme Court said you can hold him as an enemy combatant, but you need to give him due process.
Oh, you're talking about Hamdi now,
yeah,
right?
Hamdi, okay. Right.
That's
Hamdi.
Correct.
And then in the Padilla case, which is much more similar to the Al-Mari case, Padilla was picked up also in Illinois at Chicago's O'Hare Airport. Like Al-Mari, was detained originally as a material witness. And then Padilla then was designated enemy combatant by the president and transferred to the military brig in South Carolina. And so the case was, well, it was a sort of a long case, but it, you know, initially it went to the Supreme Court, and the court dismissed the case, said that Padilla had to refile his habeas challenge in the district where he was detained. He was originally filed it in the Second Circuit, which covers New York and Connecticut and Vermont, because that's where he was declared an enemy combatant, but the court ruled that he had to bring the challenge in South Carolina, which is where he was held. So it went up again. The district judge in Padilla granted relief to Padilla, but the Fourth Circuit reversed and said that the president had the authority to detain Padilla because he had engaged in combat, they said, in Afghanistan, like Hamdi did, and then came to the United States to commit terrorist acts here, and that his detention was proper. But then what happened next is quite remarkable. Padilla appealed to the Supreme Court, and 2 days before the government's response to Padilla's petition for review in the Supreme Court was due, the government charged him criminally and took him from the brig in South Carolina to a civilian jail in Florida, and is now proceeding with a criminal case against him. So the government essentially abandoned its policy of declaring people arrested in the United States as enemy combatants before the Supreme Court could review the decision. It essentially ducked and avoided Supreme Court review, I think because it recognized this policy is simply invalid and illegal.
But let me talk about the distinction for a second with you, and then we'll go to what's going to happen next in the case. The distinction, at least from what you're saying, and of course what the Al-Mari case, two judges in Al-Mari said, was that both Hamdi and Padilla, at least there was a link with a battlefield, according to the government. Whereas in Al-Mari, there was no link with a battlefield. He was simply an alleged terrorist. And they said it might be one thing to do what you did with Padilla and or Hamdi, but it's quite something else to do it with somebody who has no relationship to a battlefield. And that's going beyond the laws of war, and you can't really call someone an enemy combatant. Would that be a right way to phrase this?
That's exactly right, Michael. They distinguished the case in Padilla by saying that, as you said, Padilla there was a link, a nexus connection to the law of war and to traditional conceptions of what a combatant was, because the government alleged that Padilla carried a rifle in Afghanistan with the Taliban, so he was a combatant. But in Al-Mari, they made no such allegation. Essentially, he was a person, a civilian in the United States, who was accused of knowing bad people and plotting to commit bad acts, plotting to make crimes. And someone like that, the court said, you cannot militarize. You cannot put him in military detention. If you want to detain him, you have to subject him to charges, to criminal charges, or because he's a non-citizen, you could seek to deport him and remove him from the country. But you can't hold him as a combatant.
Now, here's my one big question, as You and I and others, many of us represent Guantanamo detainees. And of course, the question that comes out of this case, and of course, there's a link in this case with the United States, but the court's reasoning, it seemed to me, is saying that, for example, people held at Guantanamo who had no link to the war in Afghanistan or in Iraq, people who were picked up in the Gambia, people who were picked up in the Philippines, people even picked up in Iraq or Afghanistan who were just allegedly involved with Al-Qaeda, arguably what the court's reasoning is that those people cannot be held as enemy combatants. They have to be charged. Now, that's what I could pull out of the opinion, but am I right, or is this linked to the United States somehow involved?
It is and it isn't. It's linked to the United States in that the court, you know, reached only the question of whether someone in, you know, a legal resident alien in the United States has protected by the Constitution and by the Due Process Clause. And so some of the limits on who can be declared an enemy combatant or not is tied to the protection of what the Constitution would allow. But it transcends that, as you point out, because it rejects the sweeping interpretation of the what's called the authorization for use of military force, which is what justified the invasion of Afghanistan after September 11th as a global dragnet detention power. It says this doesn't give you the right to pick up people in the United States and label them enemy combatants. As you said, you can certainly draw from that you can't pick up people in Bosnia, in the Gambia, people who have like Mr. Omari, have no connection to combat and call them enemy combatants.
The judge's reasoning clearly says that, to me, that you can't, that it really undercuts the president's, you know, argument about the so-called global war on terror and picking up people all over the world as enemy combatants. The question is going to be whether that statement of the law is enforceable for someone who's not picked up in the United States. It seems to me the judge was pretty clear that the term enemy combatants in the Third and Fourth Convention don't really apply to people picked up in the global war on terror that aren't connected to military. But the question is whether anybody outside the United States is going to be able to enforce that. Am I right on that, or is that?
Yeah, I think that the you know, certainly a strong argument can be made because it does reject, as you say, this sort of central premise of the detention policy globally, including Guantanamo, that it exceeds the authority granted to the president by the statute. He's acting sort of outside the bounds of his statutory authority, outside the bounds of his commander-in-chief authority. There's just no basis in law to call people combatants who are actually not combatants but who are civilians, and I think that principle, you know, transcends Omari's case.
We want to know what happens next, but also because I'm so deeply involved in this stuff that my questions I fear may have lost some of our listeners. So
one question: where is Omari now? Is he still in solitary, and what's the next step, as Michael just asked?
Yes, he's still in solitary confinement. He's not, for example, been able to speak to or see his family, his wife or five children or elderly parents in 5 years, actually. And he is, his conditions have improved somewhat, and thanks to a lawsuit that we filed, a separate lawsuit challenging his conditions. But, you know, he's under severe restrictions still. And what happens next is the government will appeal. They've announced they're going to seek review by the full Court of Appeals.
And let's just explain to our listeners what that means. This was heard by a two-judge panel, correct?
Three-judge panel. The decision was on whether he could be held was two judges said he couldn't be held as an enemy combatant, and one judge said dissented and said he could. But it was a decision by three judges. But there's a provision in the rules that allow a party to seek review of a decision by a panel before the entire full appeals court for that circuit. So the government could seek review before, I believe it's all 13 judges of the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Now, that may or may not be granted.
Isn't it unusual? Those requests are granted not as frequently as one might expect, correct?
That's correct.
So if it goes to the full panel, what do you think will happen? Were you surprised with this decision by the three judges?
We were certainly very happy, obviously, with the decision and the values that and the principles that it affirmed. I mean, you know, it's hard to say because I think, you know, to me and I think to many others, the sort of proposition that the president can just pick someone up, you know, at their home, at their school, at their place of work, and declare them an enemy combatant and not try them as the Bill of Rights and our founders required is to me, so it's sort of hard to imagine we're even talking about this. So in that sense, it wasn't surprising, but certainly the case raises issues, and you know, not everyone is of the same view. So you know, I don't want to say surprised or not, but I think the proposition that's at issue here is so far afield from what our country stands for and what the law allows.
I just wanted to remind our listeners, if they've just tuned in, we're speaking with Jonathan Heifetz, the litigation director at the Liberty and National Security Project at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School. Jonathan, let me go back to something you said at the when you said that he came here with his wife and five kids to go to school, was picked up on some minor charges, and then later on was tortured. How do you know that? What was done to him? Where was he tortured? Was this ever discussed in front of these judges? What's the story on that?
How we know? Well, we know from speaking with him, and the allegations are essentially unrebutted. You know, what was done was, you know, he was put in the brig, incommunicado, cut off from all contact with the outside world, including his attorneys, who he was in contact with during his criminal case. So he was alone in the brig. He was kept in a tiny cell. He was denied even the ability to go outside his cell, denied things as basic as like sunlight and fresh air. He was denied a Quran for a period of time, and also denied all, you know, other basic religious items. He was not able, they would not tell him the direction that Mecca was in. They would deny him water to purify himself when he wanted to pray, deny him, you know, basic things, basic books for his religion. He was also subjected to all kinds of sensory deprivation, extremes of heat and cold, noises, all the things to really essentially designed to drive him insane. I mean, a whole range, there were threats made against him and his family. They threatened that, you know, if he didn't, he didn't give information they believed he had, they would send his wife and five children to Egypt to be raped. Really just a host of reprehensible conduct, which the government has not really defended. They just, they've said in response is, well, it doesn't matter because you don't have a right to bring this case in court anyhow because you're an enemy combatant. So you don't actually have a right to sue over your treatment and conditions of confinement.
Do the judges comment on these stories that you put into your papers?
Well, the case is still pending on what's called motion to dismiss. The government's, you know, is saying that there's no, you know, that the court doesn't even have the power to hear that these claims. And since that time, and I think in response to the lawsuit and the publicity over his conditions and the conditions of detainees generally, things have improved somewhat. And also thanks to the people at the brig. I think, you know, the people out there, you know, the men and women who work there, who were responsible for Mr. Almari, you know, many of them recognized that what was being done was wrong. And it really comes, this is not, you know, rogue officers, you know, acting out. This is a policy that's set at the highest level of the administration by the Secretary of Defense and those working directly for him to subject Mr. Almari to torture and other abuse. I mean, I think that's the reason why, or a main reason why, they took him and plucked him from the criminal justice system where he had rights and put him in the brig where he has no rights, so they could, so to speak, have their way with him and subject him to these sort of horrors, because it would be without any kind of oversight, without any kind of review.
I think that it's absolutely central to underline what you said, that this policy has come from the top down. How could have somebody survived being torn out of their family for 5 years, not seeing their kids, being subjected to all this? It wouldn't surprise me if the government succeeded in their intent to drive them crazy.
Well, then they did for a time. There was a period in winter of 05, it was, where, you know, he thought he was losing his mind. He was in really shape, in a shape of you're completely falling apart. And there have been some long-term consequences, physical and mental. However, you know, I mean, it's a testament to, you know, his resiliency that he's been able to, you know, sort of maintain his sanity. And as I said, you know, his conditions have improved, and also in large part due to, in particular, the efforts of my co-counsel, Andy Savage, in South Carolina, who is able to visit, you know, visit him, and, you know, is serves as his real principal contact with the outside world. Because aside from him and aside from me and his other lawyers, there's no one. There's no one else to talk to. He's not, as I said, permitted to speak to his family. He's not even allowed phone calls to his wife and five children. And I'm talking about monitored phone calls the government would be free to listen into for to ensure security. But they don't even allow him that. I mean, this is a policy of indefinite detention and isolation that in itself is really a form of torture, in my view.
Jonathan Heifetz, your final thoughts on this. What does this victory mean for the civil liberties and civil rights of American people?
It's a victory for the Constitution, it's a victory for the rule of law, and it's a vindication of the principles that this country was founded on, Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and a rejection of the administration's post 9/11 detention policies that seek to dispense with everything we cherish merely based on executive say-so.
Jonathan, it's been a pleasure once again to have you on Law and Disorder, and we look forward to hopefully a positive update in the future. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jonathan, and congratulations again. It's really a,
good work.
Just a major victory. I mean, everybody that I meet is just talks about it, and, you know, although, you know, after we all won the Supreme Court decision a couple of years ago, they all said it restored their faith in America. So we'll see if this one really does.
Yeah, I think so. She really shoved it up there.
I know. It was good. Great, Jonathan.
Yeah,
thanks.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
There's a debate that I would urge everybody to come to Monday night, June 18th, 7 o'clock at the CUNY Graduate Center. That's on 365 Fifth Avenue at 34th Street. The debate is entitled, Can Progressives Move the Democratic Party to the Left? Big question mark. That's Monday night, 7 o'clock at the CUNY Graduate Center. The debaters are Stanley Aronowitz, who you've heard on this show, who just wrote Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. And Laura Flanders is the other person. She's just written a book called Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. The debate is about whether or not, as a strategy for social change, we can reform the Democratic Party. I have an answer to that. Michael does, and so does Heidi. But there's going to be debate on that question. It's really a central question that faces us. Is, you know, what should we do next in terms of strategy? Monday night.
That's tonight.
At 7 o'clock at the CUNY Graduate Center, 34th Street and 5th Avenue, 365 5th Avenue. Hope to see you there.
Children as young as 7 years old detained in secret CIA prisons are some of the startling details unearthed by a recent report drafted by six human rights groups, including Amnesty International, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice at the New York University School of Law. The report is entitled Off the Record, U.S. Responsibility for Enforced Disappearances in the War on Terror. It details aspects of the CIA detention program that the U.S. government has actively tried to conceal. such as the locations where prisoners may have been held, the mistreatment they endured, and the countries to which they may have been transferred. The report names 39 people believed to be disappeared from countries such as Egypt, Kenya, Libya, Morocco, Pakistan, and Spain. Joining us to talk about this report is Meg Satterthwaite, director of the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice at the New York University Law School. Welcome, Meg, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much for having me.
Meg, this is exciting news. The report, Off the Record, U.S. Responsibility for Enforced Disappearances in the War on Terror. And you've been working on this with several other groups. Can you give us, in a nutshell overview, what's it about, what's in the report?
Sure. Well, I'd first like to actually just note all of the groups involved in the project, because the fact of the collaboration is actually part of the strength of the report.
So perfect.
The report was actually put together by Amnesty International, Caged Prisoners, the Center for Constitutional Rights, Human Rights Watch, the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice, and REPRIEVE. And what we did was to actually come together and really pool our resources in terms of the research we had done, both from public sources and then also from investigations on the ground and interviews with former detainees. And we tried to come up with the most comprehensive accounting we could, and we did end up with 39 names of people who we believe are in U.S. secret detention. So the purpose of the report really is to give a snapshot of people we believe are still in the secret detention program or who have been in the secret detention program whose fate and whereabouts still remain unknown.
Before we get into specifics, I recall that on September 6, President Bush said that 14 people had been moved to Guantanamo, with the implication that there were no longer people around the country in secret detention. Do you think that was the implication?
Absolutely. He, in fact, said that at that time the program was, what he said, empty. He very pointedly, however, kept open the possibility of using the program and made a long statement about how the program was very vital and important to fighting the war on terror. So all of us who were listening to that, who had been following the issue for a while, really suspected that if the program was in fact empty, it was empty for a temporary period. So what we've done here is to really document that the program is active and that the obligations under international law that the U.S. had at that moment remain active, and that they need to both stop the use of disappearances and also clarify the fate of people who are still missing.
In detailing some of the locations where prisoners may have been held, you said there was both independent research that the groups conducted as well as in public information. How did you find the locations?
Yeah. So the locations actually still, unfortunately, remain unconfirmed in the sense that we don't know for sure from official sources where the locations are. And in fact, that was something that President Bush again said was a closely held secret on September 6th. So what we have are suspicions, and now, after the Council of Europe report of last week, June 8, 2007, we have confirmation from the Council of Europe that there were sites in Romania and Poland, and then there are also reports of use of sites in, of course, Guantanamo, which has been shut down apparently, Thailand, which apparently has also been shut down, and then potentially still in use are sites in North Africa and Afghanistan. Now, what we do have in the report in terms of locations is some witness testimony from people who had been held, in particular in some of the sites where they were later moved out of. So I'm thinking specifically of Bagram Air Base.
There are no sites in the United States, I assume.
Of course not, because, of course, the U.S. government is attempting to keep people outside of the U.S. legal system, and they realize right. that, you know, even the conservative courts would exercise some form of jurisdiction over people who are brought into the U.S.
Before we go to individuals, can you describe something about what happens in these sites, what they're like?
Yes. So based on people who've come out of the sites, we actually know quite a bit now. So the first thing to say is, of course, that these sites are places where the quote-unquote alternative procedures have been used, and that's President Bush's terms, but what we know those amount to are torture and cruel and human degrading treatment. So things like waterboarding, all of the sensory deprivation, sensory manipulation, extreme heat and cold, stress positions, and then really I think one of the worst forms of abuse that people talk about who've been through the system is just the inability to ever see anyone who's anyone other than an interrogator or a guard. And what we're talking about is a system where even the guards have complete black outfits on. They have masks over their face. So the point of it is to really disassociate people from their own kind of human experience. They're very antiseptic locations, at least the refurbished ones or the new ones that we've heard about that are probably the ones that were in Eastern Europe. So they have things, for example, like stainless steel utilities and video cameras that are used.
A stunning report that has come out is that children as young as 7 years old have been detained. Is that true?
It is true. This was one of the most sort of horrifying things, I think, for the folks who are involved in the research. What we found is that there are kind of two ways in which children have been held. One, they've been scooped up at the same time as an individual who's being sought. So a whole family will sometimes be scooped up, and they may be held for a period of time, even after they actually apprehended the person who was being sought. And then the second way, which was talked about explicitly in the report in relation to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's children, is that they were actually picked up before KSM himself was picked up, and they were interrogated, apparently, really to try to figure out what their father had supposedly been doing.
KSM is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for our listeners.
How long were they held after they were picked up?
Well, we don't know. What we know is that they were interrogated in Pakistan, and then they were actually transferred out of Pakistan in U.S. custody. So we don't know in total how long. What's interesting is that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed himself, in his Combatant Status Review Tribunal at Guantanamo, mentioned that they were in detention for 4 months. So clearly the U.S. government was telling KSM that his children were in detention. So that also gives a clue as to why they would detain children.
It gives you a clue about their hypocrisy on family values, too.
Absolutely.
Meg, I have a question. In preparing this report, did you or others have the opportunity to talk to any of the children who'd been detained?
We didn't actually try to talk to the children. Thankfully,
they've been through enough.
Thankfully, yeah, exactly. Thankfully, we had access to family members who could already just tell us what had happened. And we didn't feel, since the report wasn't focusing on children's firsthand experiences, that it was necessary to talk to them.
Right.
What can you tell our listeners about what we can do to try to get more publicity on these sites and what we can do to close them down?
Well, I think one of the things that's important is that just people start talking about it. I think there's been a lot of attention to the rendition program, which is incredibly important and closely linked to the secret detention program. But strangely, there hasn't been as much attention to the secret detention program. So I think people sort of educating themselves about that is really important. And then I think there also needs to be a call to Congress to actually exercise some supervision and oversight into this program. And in fact, what that would require is, of course, shutting down the program since it's a violation of international human rights that are binding on the U.S.
These are basically, as you say in the report, enforced disappearances. But there's one other element to this report I want to go to. You know, I remember when Bush made a statement which sort of people laughed at and everybody cheered actually in Congress, and the Republicans and Democrats stood up together when he said, I don't know the exact quote, but we've gotten rid of a lot of Al-Qaeda people and they're either in prison somewhere or they'll no longer be heard from again or no longer a problem.
No longer a threat, the guy
said. I don't know if you remember the quote, Meg.
Well, there's a couple of things. President Bush actually and the DNI referred to people being taken off the battlefield or being taken out of action. But there's a list that is very interesting list, which is a list of people who are, quote-unquote, no longer a threat. And that was a list that was read into the congressional record. And it's a very strange list because it includes people who have been killed. It includes people who apparently have been picked up and placed into secret detention. Essentially, the point is that the administration and certain parts of Congress are considering killing and detaining people in the same category.
Well, here's what your report actually uses the term, in quotes, terrorists no longer a threat.
Yep.
I don't know what to make of it. One part I make of it is those may be people that are not just detained, but the people may have been murdered by the United States once they figured out, in their view, that somebody shouldn't be around anymore. Is that a feasible conclusion?
I think it is, and it's actually part of why more pressure is needed to find out who has actually been killed and who's been detained. What we know about this system, the high-value, quote-unquote, high-value detainee program, is that, and this is through the Dick Marty report from the Council of Europe, that each person apparently was a subject of a, quote, kill, capture, or detain order. And that would be an order that would have been signed off at various different levels. And apparently, according to the Dick Marty report, was subject to legal review, which means that in some instances, people are being either killed, captured, or detained as though those are all the same consequence.
Wow. It's conceivable that a person could be picked up anywhere in the world, taken to one of these secret sites, an order like that issued, and the person actually get murdered. Is that right?
We don't know. What's unclear is there any kind of directive saying that the U.S. has to prefer detention, which, of course, you know, would be required under human rights law and under Geneva, under international humanitarian law. But it's unclear if a preference like that is required. So it could be that they're at liberty once this order is comes down and is approved to actually kill instead of detaining.
So do you know for a fact that kill, capture, or detain orders have been issued?
We don't. We know only from Dick Marty's report because we haven't had access to any of those documents.
Now, if in fact an order like that was issued, is that legal?
Under international human rights law, certainly not legal.
What about under American law?
Under American law, I would argue it's not legal either. I'd love to see the justification, and that's actually something we're seeking in the lawsuit, the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that we filed.
Yeah, you should mention that. I don't know if you did yet. Some groups filed the Freedom of Information Act request.
Right. So basically, it was three groups. It's Amnesty International, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and then the International Human Rights Clinic at NYU, which I teach. And what we're seeking is just the basic facts relating to the secret detention and rendition program. And one of the things that would be included in that category of requests is things like, what is the legal authorization for a kill, capture, detain order?
Couldn't they call that classified information, though?
Certainly. What we've had, of course, is a bunch of action below, you know, before we even filed the lawsuit at the administrative level, where we were met in some instances with claims that documents couldn't be released for that reason. So we do anticipate having to litigate that issue.
Let me ask another question about the kill, capture, and detain. Could you technically...
Is it possible
that people were actually detained and then killed even though they were detained?
We haven't had any reports of that, but we have no way of knowing.
And why would they issue?
Right,
think they'd want to keep that hush-hush.
One would think.
Right. But the way it sounded to me, I mean, I put this all together. It's conceivable they may have just disposed of people after they captured them.
Yeah,
disposed or murdered is the better word.
Sounded to me that way too, Meg. I remember when Bush spoke to Congress and he gave that characteristic smirk and said, let me reassure you that these people are no longer a threat. And everybody rose to their feet, Republicans and Democrats, and they clapped for him. It was an echo of that line out of Bush.
It certainly has that ring of, I mean, it's extremely ominous. And in fact, according to Dick Marty, these orders are called KCD orders. So they even have sort of the lingo for them, which would lead one to believe, again, that, you know, the three things are potential options.
We've been speaking with Meg Satterwhite, who's the director of the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice at the NYU Law School.
Where can we get this report? Is it online anywhere?
It is. It's actually online on the website of all of those different organizations. And I'll just give you ours, but just keep in mind it's available on all those different websites. Ours is chrgj.org.
Say it again.
chrgj.org.
We'll link it up with ours here at lawanddisorder.org.
Great.
I think your next grant should be for changing the name of the website.
Yeah. It's a tongue twister, Meg.
You can call it Kill, Capture, and Detain.
You can also get it at ccr-ny.org, which isn't that much better either. But anyway, the report is called Off the Record. I have to tell people, you just go read it. It is completely chilling. Just completely chilling. And Meg, really, I know you were instrumental in it, and congratulations.
Well, thanks very much for having me on. It was great to be here.
Thanks,
yeah.
Meg.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You know what? One thing I found shocking about that report is Here you have 39 people who they can't find, who may have actually been murdered in detention. The report came out. It got a little bit of attention, but people in this country should be outraged. This is basically picking up people around the world, taking them to secret detention facilities, and conceivably murdering them. I really want to encourage our people to go and read this report on the various websites. You have the center's website, ccr-ny.org, the Law and Disorder website, lawanddisorder.org. Read it and just be shocked that we are sitting here while people are in secret detention who've been essentially disappeared. And this is Pinochet Redux, basically. Pinochet again.
Michael, it makes me wonder how many high-level officials in this country know about these centers.
Well, you know, for starters, what kills me here, what completely kills me, is we've known about secret detention facilities for a very long time. And now we're sitting there with a Democratic Congress, and they might as well be sitting on their hands. Why don't they tomorrow just say, we're not going to give you any money to run secret CIA detention facilities? There's no veto. They just don't have to appropriate the money. And so what you're talking about here is not just Bush, not just some Republicans. You're talking about essentially the rulers of this country, the Congress, the Bush administration, and conceivably the courts, who have not yet been willing to do anything about it, from giving us information to anything else, all essentially in a conspiracy to disappear people and possibly murder them. It's pretty shocking.
Well, it's become institutionalized almost, just as torture has lost the shock value that it held for most of us for so long.
When you're saying the Democrats sat on their hands, the one time they didn't sat on their hands, they actually raised their hands and voted for the appropriations for the war in Iraq, which underlines all this stuff. And the irony to me was that this very same week they voted for that, the majority of the parliament in Iraq voted to ask the United States to get out.
We can't say much good about the parliament. We can't say much good about Iraq. We can certainly say nothing good about what's happened in our Congress, and we can only say bad because they have continued the war. Now, one part of this that was mentioned briefly by Meg and the others is what's called the Dick Marty Report. Dick Marty is a Swiss senator who has been appointed really by the European Union to investigate renditions, disappearances, and these secret sites. And this is the second report that Dick Marty has issued. He issued it about the same time as the Center for Constitutional Rights and the NYU Center issued their report. And this report is much stronger than his first report. This report, he really details what happened in Europe, Europe's complicity, and really talks about the fact that Romania and Poland were used as secret CIA sites.
I'd just like to note that the countries Germany and Italy were, in Marty's words, obstructing his investigations into secret detentions, which is quite troubling.
So we not only have our Congress, our Bush administration, and our courts, we now have cooperation from the so-called civilized countries of Western Europe in disappearing, kidnapping, torturing, and murdering people.
How can you get more information on the Marty Report?
We'll have a link to the Marty Report on our website, lawanddisorder.org. We urge everyone to read this and Meg's and the other organizational reports, too.
In a little happier announcement, today we're recording the show on June 13th, which happens to be Michael Ratner's birthday. And I just got a notice from one of my friends that says, "Happy birthday, Michael. A quick search of the Google informed me that you share your birthday with and give some people who I don't care about, like Samuel Taylor, a playwright or something, William Butler Yeats, who I care about, Harriet Beecher Stowe, who I care about a lot, who, of course, wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin." And then it says, "And most important, born in 1986, so they're a little bit younger than me, Mary Kate and Ashley Olsen."
No.
Yes. Who I think are two singers of some sort.
I don't know.
Michael,
like
celebrities.
Boppers, right? I don't know, but happy birthday, Michael.
Happy birthday,
anyway,
Michael.
There you go. They're a little younger than I am, but
but
I'm
you
really
have
happy
the same
to be there with Kate
fighting
and
spirit.
You came down to the Olsen sisters.
You came down to the studio.
The twins.
On your birthday.
The
happy birthday.
The
there you go.
I share a birthday with Marlon Brando and Eddie Murphy.
Whoa.
Wow.
Michael, when's your birthday?
I'm going to be getting Medicare on October 10th.
Congratulations.
But I wanted to say there's a debate that I would urge everybody to come to Monday night, June 18th, 7 o'clock at the CUNY Graduate Center. That's on 365 Fifth Avenue at 34th Street. The debate is entitled, "Can Progressives Move the Democratic Party to the Left?" Big question mark. That's Monday night, 7 o'clock at the CUNY Graduate Center. The debaters are Stanley Aronowitz, who you've heard on this show, who just wrote Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. And Laura Flanders is the other person. She's just written a book called Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. The debate is about whether or not, as a strategy for social change, we can reform the Democratic Party. I have an answer to that. Michael does, and so does Heidi. But there's going to be debate on that question. It's really a central question that faces us. Is, you know, what should we do next in terms of strategy? Monday night.
That's tonight.
At 7 o'clock at the CUNY Graduate Center, 34th Street and 5th Avenue, 365 5th Avenue. Hope to see you there.
Thinking about this debate, think about the Winter Palace, think about the fall of the Bastille, and think about whether the Democrats would have ever done either of those things. If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
That's lawanddisorder.org.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Good evening. I'd like to report on the state of our war against the American people. We're mounting a sustained campaign to crack down on every American and every person of every faith and every nation and to bring them to justice. All missions are being executed according to plan without warning or provocation. Americans are being swept up in an international dragnet. Thousands of FBI agents are on the trail of other citizens here and abroad. It has everything to do with hate and evil and murder and prejudice. America's strong, strong, strong.
Federal agents, we are armed!
What would you do if you knew all the things we knew? Would you stand up for truth? Or would you turn away to? And then what if you saw all of the things that's wrong? Would you stand tall and strong, or would you turn and walk away? What would you do if you knew all the things we knew? Would you stand up for truth, or would you turn away too? And then what if you saw all of the things that's wrong? Would you stand tall and strong, or would you turn and walk away?
I see a message from the government. Like every day, I watch it and listen and call them all suckers. They wanted me about Osama or whatever. Picture me buying the scam, I said never. You in tune to a hard truth, soldier spitting. I stay committed, gives a f- to die, I lose commission. It's all a part of fighting devil state mind control. And all about the battle for your body, mind, and soul. And now I'm hoping you don't close your mind so they shape you. Don't forget they made us slaves, gave us AIDS and raped us. Another push season mean another war for profit. All in secret so the public never seek to stop it. Triple six, all connected. Stole the votes, they control the race and take elections. It's the Skull and Bones Freemason Kill Committee. See the dragon get you're in every city.
What would you do if you
what would you do?
Knew all the things we knew? Would you stand up for truth? Or would you turn away too? And then what if you saw all of the things that's wrong? Would you stand tall and strong? Or would you turn and walk?
Now ask yourself who's the one with the most to gain. 4-9-11 mother couldn't stand his name. Now even is waving flags like they lost their mind. Everybody got opinions but don't know the time. Cause America's been took, it's plain to see. The oldest trick in the book is making enemy. A phony evil so the government can do its dirt and take away your freedom, lock and load, beat and search. Ain't nothing changed but more colored people locked in prison. These pigs still beat us but it seems we forgetting. But I remember 4 September how these devils do it.
Giuliani, ask Diallo how he doing. We in the streets, holla jail to the thief. Follow waving flags, bring these dragons to their knees. Oil, blood, money, make these killers ride cold. Suspicious suicide, people dying never told. It's all a part of playing God, so you think we need them. While being Ashcroft, take away your rights to freedom. Bear witness to the sickness of these dictators. Hope you understand the time, brother, cause it's major.
What would you do if you do?
Why my records always come the same? Keep it real, ain't no fillers, motherfucker blingin'. Mine eyes seen the gory of the coming of the beast. So every story, every word I'm saying, peace. See, you could witness the Illuminati body count. Don't be surprised, these is devils that I'm talking about. You think a couple thousand lies mean the killers? I swear to God, we the ones, ain't no villains. Or any other word they think to demonize a country. Ain't no terror threat unless approval rating slumping. So I'ma say it for the record, we the ones that planned it. Ain't no other country took a part, I had their hand in. Just a way to keep you scary so you think you need them. Praising Bush while that killer take away your freedom. How many of us got discovered but ignore the symptoms? Talking loud but ain't nobody saying. And with the Fourth Amendment gone, eyes are on the first. That's why I'm spitting cyanide each and every verse. I see the Carlisle Group and Harris bank accounts. I see them plead the Fifth each and every session now. And while Reichstag burns, see the public buy it. I see the profiling, see the media's compliance. War is good for business, see the vicious make a savior. Hope you understand the time, brother, cause it's major.
What would you do if you knew all the things we know? Would you stand up for truth? Would you turn away too? And then what if you saw all of the things that's wrong? Would you stand tall and strong? Or would you turn and walk away? What would you do if you knew all the things we knew? Would you stand up for truth? Or would you turn away too? And then what if you saw all of the things that's wrong? Would you stand tall?
How much money they've spent trying to silence good people who have put their lives on the line to fight for change.